Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. I'm here with my two compadres, as always. Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the OIG's LA field office, now a manager on our SIU team. And Matt Kachansky, retired executive from HHS OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and now our payment integrity director here on the SIU team. And I'm still Eric Rubenstein, senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse. So today we want to talk about if you're following the funny papers and the press releases that are out there, last week or so, there was another one of what has now become at least a once a year or twice a year, as they call the national takedown or the roundup, spearheaded by DOJ with its law enforcement partners, typically HHS OIG, the FBI, and some ancillary agencies. When you start to read these press releases, one of the things that you start to notice is that more agencies that you never heard of involved in healthcare fraud are now getting involved. I think one of the cases involved something that the ATF got involved with. Another one, I think, had some HSI, Homeland Security investigations, involved with. So we're starting to see these cases start to get tentacles and start to get other things, which is an important piece of that puzzle, because what we're really starting to see are these instances in which providers are engaged in other types of behavior that, you know, we would consider to be some of the traditional crimes that are out there, right? Guns, or if you've got HSI, there could be some immigration issues. Sometimes we're seeing the DEA involved. So this big roundup, over $2 billion in exposure. Again, what's interesting is well over 100 providers and people in the healthcare industry have been charged. And interestingly enough, it's $2 billion, and yet we're still talking about the catheter case, which was $2 billion for seven entities. So it's all relative, right? But if you read the press release that was out in kind of global discussions, it's really the stuff that's out there. And, you know, Wade, you and I, we did back in the day the Retro Fraud podcast, and we talked about the fact that the circus never changes, right? It's the clowns that rotate. And if you read the fraud schemes that led up to this roundup, it's the same stuff. It's almost like Groundhog Day, or it's almost like we never learn from our mistakes. Right? The definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing and hope for a different outcome. But again, we live in a world of pay and chase, and so it should not be a surprise that a lot of these things are out there. But Wade, I want to start with you, because one of the things that really resonated with me was that one of the cases that that was charged involved a provider billing for these wound care kits, these amniotic wound care bandages, and there's a lot of use of it off-label. There's also a lot of use of the injections off-label for some items, services, and procedures that aren't covered. But, you know, the thing that resonated when I read this press release was the premise of patient harm. And, you know, we've talked a lot about that, and that it's, you know, it's all hands on deck. But really, the you know, from the SIU perspective, and we'll talk a little bit more globally, is that, you know, these roundups and these press releases should create opportunities for SIU. You know, I blogged a couple of weeks ago on LinkedIn about how SIUs should be setting up things like Google Alerts and getting the email blasts that come out from the Department of Justice on roundups and on cases, because they do create actionable intelligence items. But let's start with, like, from the patient harm perspective, you know, from the SIU piece of the puzzle, you know, when you see a case that's got a potential patient harm, it really should be something that becomes an SIU priority, right? You want to make sure that this provider is either not billing your program, or if they are billing your program, are they billing your program for the things that got them in into the world of being charged, and sort of that reprioritization, right? It's a management related issue, is to troll these different things and identify where the, you know, not ROI. We're talking about how do you have something that's actionable for your program from a patient safety, you know, a plan still has to protect its member base.
Yeah, we've talked about in the past, as far as like triaging cases, the things you look at, a lot of times loss is the main thing, but the one that really puts a case as a highest of priorities is if there is patient harm. So it when these press releases comes out, it's almost like a responsibility for an MCO SIU to kind of pay attention to make sure that the same type of thing isn't happening within their own organization or with their providers that are billing for their members. So, you know, they should always be looking for the same types of schemes just to kind of make sure that it's not on their radar, if it should be on their radar and it hasn't been. So these large scale takedowns are a good kind of a blast to let everybody know what's going on as far as different new schemes, like the old schemes that are coming back again, like we always talk about, but especially in patient harm. If there's a scheme that's going on and it's harming people, and it's possible that it's harming their members, it's really a responsibility for them to look into that and kind of do all their checks and balances to make sure it's not happening within their program.
Yeah, it's almost like when a pharmacy has to do a drug utilization review, right? Are there two medications that are going to have some adverse reaction? It's a little bit in the same vein. Like, the plan needs to look and say, hey, has this provider been billing us for something that's gotten them in trouble? And it's not just a fraud issue, but there's a potential patient harm related issue out there. So, you know, these become actionable intelligence pieces. So, you know, before I go to Matt, I just want to just kind of circle back with you on a few other things. So the other big area that we saw a bunch of people charged with was through home health, right? It's no secret. Home health is a huge area of fraud. There are a million schemes that are out there. The one that we see most commonly with our Medicaid clients, and you worked a ton on this, is the electronic visit verification and the timesheet potential frauds. You know, you see these cases where the HHA, the home health aide, not the organization itself, but the aide gets charged with fraud because they made, you know, I remember one case out of DC a few years ago where the aide received something like $200,000 or $300,000 in salary because they were working in five different places and they were putting in for 40 hours a week. And those claims were tainted by fraud because the HHA was only working a few hours a week. And this general lack of coordination, you know, if Wade McFall is working for four different HHAs, the home health agency doesn't know that Wade McFall's working for four different places, or we hope that they don't know, right? And that they're only working at one place, and you know, the home health agency doesn't know you're making $200,000 or $300,000. So you've worked a bunch of these cases, right? And you see obviously a lot of these gaps. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, how sometimes these cases can be a challenge, because if you're not putting those dots together, if you don't know that Wade McFall is working at four different places, like, there's a challenge in being able to uncover these without, you know, in some cases, a whistleblower. But walk us through a little bit about what those kind of cases look like and what some of those challenges might be.
Well, you're right that it would be difficult for a home health agency to necessarily know that their aide is working in multiple, you know, four different companies. But the electronic verification system, it's really, it's easy to write, you know, algorithms and edits and types of things on regular data when you're doing data analysis. But when you have something where they typically have to check in electronically and it's based off of their license number or whatever identifier, so it should be really easy for the state to have algorithms that kick out, you know, this person is either working for multiple companies, which I guess technically isn't illegal as long as they're working the hours that they're, you know, they're supposed to be working. They could be working 10 hours for one company per week and 10 for another, and that's fine. But like you say, when they're working 40 hours for one company and maybe 30 for another, the math just doesn't add up. And with something like the electronic verification system, it should be relatively easy. I mean, I'm not a data scientist, but it should be pretty easy to write some kind of program that kicks that out when it's almost like the impossible day algorithm that we use. If a home health aide is billing or it's showing up on the electronic verification system for more than 40 hours a week, that's probably something that should be looked into.
Yeah. So, you know, from the SIU perspective, the payment integrity perspective, the non-law enforcement perspective, you know, the SIUs are kind of, it is what it is, right? Because they're only seeing that plan. Now, we have a little bit of a unique situation here, right, at Advise, because we've got a concentration of Medicaid plans that we're the SIU for. So we're able to look across multiple payers within our body of clients that are at least regionally located, where you can, you know, we can see at least some data. Now, obviously in the billing data, you don't see that granularity of things, but you can certainly cross over some of the lines on individual providers. You know, if a provider is bilking one plan, they're probably bilking other plans, but certainly at the state level or higher, there is the ability to look across and see things like, you know, for a particular individual at an HHA, you know, are they crossing over those lines? It does take a lot of coordination, right? The state's got to coordinate to be able to do that. And oftentimes the problem is that state organizations don't necessarily talk to each other, right? So you're talking about maybe in New York, OMIG or Department of Health, you know, are they talking to the state taxation or revenue department who's storing that taxpayer-related information? You know, I know, for example, in New York, we couldn't get wage reports without an ex parte order from a judge, because the state of New York treated that information as taxpayer related information, which requires a court order, similar to if we wanted to get tax returns from the IRS on an investigation. We couldn't just go to the IRS and ask them. We needed to get an ex parte order. Whereas in New Jersey, there was a law enforcement exemption and we could get W-2 reports from the state with just a request. So every state's going to have a different set of rules, which create obviously different sets of challenges on how you can conduct these in these investigations. So, you know, I think we're going to see the HHA fraud. We see these every year, right? It's always part of the OIG yep. work plan. You know, some of the other things that were part of the roundup, the DME fraud, which will never go away because it's now intrinsically connected to the telemedicine fraud, which is the telefraud cases, which we saw as part of this roundup, which we see in the work plan. And so, Matt, I now want to segue to you, because the work plan, everybody who works in the healthcare fraud, waste, abuse, payment integrity world knows the work plan, talks about the work plan. And the one thing that I've always found, not funny, but, you know, oftentimes I get asked and we get asked here at Advise about the work plan. And as retired OIG people, everybody always asks about the work plan because the OIG puts out the work plan. And I've always said, you know, when I was an OIG agent, I think I looked at the work plan twice or three times in my whole career, because at Office of Investigations, where we were, we followed the fraud schemes, right? We didn't necessarily look at the work plan, although oftentimes our cases mirrored things that were going on in the work plan. But let's talk, though, why is the work plan actually important from a payment integrity perspective? Because it has a lot of value from that payment integrity perspective.
Yeah, the work plan is the product of the other operational arms of an OIG, not the Office of Investigations, but it's the Office of Audit Services, and for HHS, the Office of Evaluation and Inspections. And what they do in producing that work plan is they look at, you know, national data on Medicare and Medicaid and state data on Medicaid, and they pinpoint what specific programs seem the most vulnerable based on perhaps the policies that are there or not there, or the some spikes in billing. They look at this and then they say, well, these are the most vulnerable. These are the things we are going to look at from an oversight, a program oversight point of view. So, and then they will conduct audits or studies of those programs and release the results. So from a payment integrity point of view, they're very important because they're pointing out these things are vulnerable to fraud, waste, and abuse, and SIU should look to those things as, you know, what's our house doing about that? Do we have that same program? What are our policies? Will we find those same things and be able to fix them? Because those audit reports also make recommendations on how to remedy the vulnerabilities. So for that, that's very important. The OI, you know, following the schemes and being more reactive rather than proactive, it's SIU should also look to those the roundups, the press releases, and have a short-term and long-term plan on how to best utilize the information that's given in those press releases. Short-term is they're naming these bad actors, right? There's individuals named. These people have either been charged or signed plea agreements or informations. Those are people, individuals. SIU should look. Are these people banging their programs for funds as well? And what is the best way to resolve that? Is it to terminate them? Is it to suspend them? Is it to put them on prepay? However, whatever the rules may apply to them based on, you know, have they pled guilty? Have they just been charged? So CMS, as a UPIC, we could not take action against an individual until they pled guilty. The indictment was seen as a charging document, had no impact on whether they should be revoked or not. We could keep an eye on them, but we couldn't take formal action against them. So each plan probably has their own policies on that. The other thing that should be looked at is, you know, once these things have gone to resolution, there's going to be exclusions from Medicare and Medicaid. SIU should take action on that. The problem with that is usually months, if not years, after these people have been charged. So there's a period of time where these folks can still bill Medicare and Medicaid as well as any other plan, even though there's probable cause that they've committed fraud. So you've really got to keep your eye on those folks to make sure that your plan is safeguarded.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, Matt, because in a lot of instances, there's in individual plan contracts, there are clauses in which it is incumbent upon the provider to notify the plan of any adverse actions against them. And oftentimes it could be, even if it's not even criminal, if it's a civil action or what have you, but certainly they should be notified. But, you know, just to kind of parlay on what you just talked about in the exclusions, which is, right, the list of excluded individuals and entities, LEIE, right, that list comes out every month. And it's updated every month in a table form, but you can look live right on the website. You can do a search and do a social security number verification, what have you. You know, the important part for some of these roundups and also for some of these press releases, and you hit right on the point, is that oftentimes by the time someone gets excluded, it could be months or years after. In some instances, I've seen where the provider has been adjudicated and has done their probation time or their prison sentence and their supervised release, and they're getting excluded 2 years later and their license has been reinstated or whatever it is. And so you almost have to look at this stuff live, meaning it's really important that if you are an SIU in a particular jurisdiction, that you are really keeping track of prosecutions that are going on. Because once someone has pleaded guilty, they have been adjudicated guilty. Sentencing is the final piece. But once someone has pleaded guilty, they are convicted, right? And you could take your administrative action against a provider after a plea of guilty has been entered and has been accepted by the court. And so you should be looking to terminate based upon that. You know, if you're waiting for your provider to let you know, you're probably going to miss the boat by some period of time where that exclusion, you know, where you're not waiting on that exclusion. The other piece is that exclusion only applies to government payer programs. If you're looking to terminate a provider, it's going to be based upon a contractual issue involving that. You know, you don't want to wait for OIG or state entity to boot you from the program. And the last piece that I want to go back to is, you know, when we look at things in these press releases involving people that are charged in credible allegations of fraud, to me, that's actionable intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. You've got something right there. And it kind of gets to this premise of intangible ROI, right? There's ROI is going to be tangible and intangible. The tangible is going to be dollars in the door from the result of recoveries and savings and however your plan chooses to calculate savings and the like. But there's also an intangible ROI, which is taking that proactive action against somebody to do something and stop the bleeding before it is actually able to, you know, people could talk about having algorithms that stop a payment and savings and all of that, but you've got actionable intelligence to get somebody out of your program who has, you know, who has been charged with something. Now, granted, there's always the argument that they're going to be charged. They haven't been convicted. Do we kick somebody out? Do we suspend them? You know, there's a lot of things that can be done. In the CMS world, on a credible allegation of fraud, they don't terminate you. They suspend payment. You can continue to do the work. I think at the end of the day, most providers just stop billing because they're not getting paid. And it obviously has a negative impact on an individual provider's ability to earn an income or whatever, but there's still the ability to do work and get actionable intelligence from that as a result of things like that and from the work plan.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, that would be the short-term actions that an SIU can take to get savings to their program by taking actions against those named individuals, you know, whether that be a payment suspension, a prepay action, whatever action you can take to protect your program funds and its beneficiaries, if it is a harm to the patient type of allegation, do that as quickly as you can. You're probably not going to be able to join any settlement or things like that where you bring money back that has been lost before, but you can save future funds by taking those protective actions. On the long term, take a look at some of those schemes that are done. You know, look beyond the individual actors. What were those schemes? What are the identifying markers for those schemes, whether it's telemed or whatever? And then look at your programs to see, going back to the OIG reports, are your programs vulnerable to those same types of actions? Here you've got concrete examples of how those vulnerabilities were taken advantage of. Now look at your programs and then start, you know, working with your SIU or working with your program integrity groups, you know, taking the actions necessary to protect those programs so that the amniotic fluid, amniotic wound care kits, see if you're being billed for that. If so, take action to protect it so that you have long-term savings based on that.
Right. You know, and the last piece of the puzzle for me is, as we kind of wrap up, is even after a person's been charged, you know, if you're a plan that's identified a large dollar amount that is at risk as a result of that charge, you know, when someone gets charged with a Medicare Medicaid fraud, oftentimes the commercial side of the world is oftentimes largely ignored. I was very fortunate in New Jersey. We had, as an office, we had really, really strong working relationships with our local commercial payers that were in New Jersey. And so oftentimes when we were working a case that was a Medicare, Medicaid fraud case, we would reach out to our commercial payer partners and, you know, learn, is there a significant dollar loss that's involved there? And, you know, I think an important piece of that puzzle is that if you've got somebody that's been criminally charged for whatever the Medicare, Medicaid fraud is, and you have a substantial dollar amount, you should be trying to reach out to that U.S. attorney's office, to that case agent, you know, which is where we get back to this whole premise of working relationships and law enforcement liaison, you know. And Wade, I know you spent a lot of time when you were at OIG as a supervisor kind of doing a lot of that work, right? There's a huge probative value that kind of brings this full circle to these arguments of, you've got a work plan issue that you want to address. You've got a roundup that occurred. There's a press release about somebody that's been charged. You know, while the money may not be there, you certainly don't lose any benefit by getting or convincing a U.S. attorney's office, hey, I've got $1 million in fraud. You know, that's $1 million more, right? So, you know, as we kind of wrap up, like, that becomes a piece of the puzzle from that SIU perspective that I think oftentimes falls at the wayside, because SIUs oftentimes think, well, they've already charged this person. There's no, like, what's the point?
Yeah, but I think another important part of that is, as you pointed out, even if the plan isn't really to get the money back, it can aid in the sentencing guideline. If it's an extra $1 million, that's going to move them a couple spots on the sentencing guideline chart. So even if there's no chance, you know, that they know that the money's gone and they're not going to do a asset forfeiture type situation, even just to charge those dollars that have been lost, it helps a lot in the sentencing guideline too. So it's definitely worth the squeeze.
Right. And particularly if you have somebody who on sentencing, so typically when somebody pleads guilty or gets convicted, sentencing is typically scheduled 60 to 90 days after that adjudication. But, you know, certainly when you get a copy of the judgment of conviction, it'll certainly help in you terminating a wayward provider from a payment integrity perspective. If what's known as the judgment of conviction, or the JOC, as they call it, has a line in there that says restitution to be paid to the following, and it's got your plan listed, you know, that really goes, it resonates very strongly within payment integrity from a provider enrollment perspective and termination, right? Getting your name out there and participating participating in these things, and then developing those partnerships and those relationships for future cases, because maybe you then get your information over to an agent or a prosecutor earlier in the process versus later in the process. You know, and again, this gets back to that conversation that we've had with why SIUs don't necessarily always talk to each other. The pot of money may be the pot of money, but this is an example of where there's that intangible ROI of keeping your program safe and secure as best you can, given that we work in a pay and chase environment. So, you know, these roundups are going to continue going, right, Matt? I mean, these have now been happening for years. Probably, you know, we know since 2017 or 18 when the first, or 16 when the first strike force came into fruition, these roundups have been at least once a year, if not more. And as you know, from both the UPIC perspective and the MCC perspective, the coordination is unbelievable, right? And the fact that you've got 30, 40 judicial districts, and, you know, these roundups can involve, you know, when you're talking about 100 or more defendants, you're talking about the coordination across jurisdictional lines, and you're talking about what could be thousands of agents, particularly if search warrants are being executed. You know, I know one of the largest cases I had about 20 defendants in it, and just to arrest 20 people, you know, you're talking about 100 agents or more to have to coordinate something of that size. So, you know, there is a ton of work that goes into these. They're going to keep coming.
Yeah, they are successful. They believe they get a deterrent effect from them. I know they get the provider community gets, we've seen changes in billing patterns after roundups. So it does have an effect. So they're going to keep doing them. There's no downside except the amount of work that goes into them.
Right. But you're sort of trying to get a bigger, you know, a huger bang for your buck. But yeah, there is a lot of work that goes into them. And yeah, I don't know if, you know, I think we can always have a debate about the deterrent factor in prosecuting providers. You know, one of the issues, you know, is deterrent, punitive, retribution, right? There's three or four different factors that are considered. Is there really a deterrent factor in arresting all of these people? I mean, we see these roundups every year. We see them sometimes twice a year. We see individual cases of tens of millions of dollars, providers in the healthcare world getting sentenced to 8 and 10 years, and in some cases more. I don't know if it has a deterrent factor. We could have a whole separate conversation. You know, one of the most frustrating instances for me was I was working on a podiatry fraud case in New Jersey, and we did a search warrant on the provider's office. And in his office, on a bulletin board, he had two newspaper clippings of two other podiatry cases that I happen to have been the case agent on, in which both of those providers were criminally prosecuted and went to prison. And this guy had those articles on his bulletin board while we were doing a search warrant. And so it was frustrating because it provided no deterrent. He actually had the articles on a bulletin board of what they did. And he was doing essentially the same thing that these two providers were doing. So it didn't really have a deterrent effect, which is obviously a little disheartening. But they're going to continue happening. But from the SIU perspective, it certainly provides actionable intelligence for us in the SIU community, now that we're wearing that other hat, to see, you know, where we could do things. And from the provider side, it's looking at these things and saying, okay, I'm not committing fraud, or at least I don't think I'm committing fraud. I may be in the waste and abuse, but what can I do to clean up my house from a provider perspective? And so maybe that is where that deterrent comes from. It's changing what that paradigm is that providers are thinking about from a compliance perspective. So we'll see how these shake out. We'll keep an eye on these pleas. We'll see what happens with them. I'm sure there's going to be another roundup by the end of the year, because they seem to come, you know, in waves, and we'll see how it continues to work to affect things. So as always, guys, it's good to see you. And as always, to our community, thanks very much for tuning in. We appreciate it. Again, you can sign up for our newsletter by going to our website. It's been fully redesigned. It's a refreshed look. We're excited to see how people think of the website. Again, you can go to the website, adviseadvizehealth.com. Sign up for our newsletter. You can get our previous podcasts through that newsletter, current podcasts through the newsletter. You can also get our podcast on our YouTube channel. You can subscribe to it. We've got some great LinkedIn Lives coming up. We've got one coming up here in July with two of our lab subject matter experts who are going to be talking about a bunch of the lab schemes that are out there. Everybody knows a lot about them. We're going to give you a little bit of an inside perspective from the investigative perspective on how these cases are out there and some of the fraud schemes that are out there. So we have a lot of stuff coming up in the next couple of months. So as always, we appreciate you taking the time, and thanks for joining us on this week's OIG Roundtable.
Thank you all.